This is the Quality News Network. Four more U.S. servicemen have been killed during a 24-hour period in Iraq, three Marines in the Anbar province yesterday, and one GI in Baghdad today. And in Afghanistan's Kandahar province, four GIs killed over the weekend, along with 70 Taliban rebels. Meeting with reporters today, President Bush conceded that the war in Iraq, with daily bombings and U.S. casualties now more than 2,600, is, in his words, straining the psyche of our country. But he also says the U.S. will not leave Iraq during his presidency. President is pledging another $230 million in humanitarian aid to Lebanon and also calling for a quick deployment of international troops to help police the fragile ceasefire there. But so far, among Western nations, only France and Italy have pledged troops. In the Far East, Bangladesh, Indonesia, and Malaysia have also offered frontline troops, but Israel is opposed because it has no diplomatic relations with those predominantly Islamic countries. Hundreds of Israeli reservists are complaining that they were rushed into war without adequate food, water, and equipment, and they're demanding an investigation in Israel. Britain has now charged 11 of the 23 suspects arrested in connection with an alleged terror plot to blow up transatlantic planes with conspiracy to commit murder. In Egypt, a fiery collision of two passenger trains at a station near Cairo has killed at least 60 people and injured more than 130. It was the third major train wreck in Egypt in the past 7 months. Iran says it will announce tomorrow a multifaceted response to the Western package of incentives offered to stop its nuclear program. But Tehran insists it will not suspend uranium enrichment altogether and that a nuclear compromise will have to be reached during future negotiations. Congo's President Joseph Kabila failed to win an outright majority in that country's historic elections over the weekend, setting off a runoff in October with a former rebel leader. The Washington Post reports that the Bush administration is now in the process of reclassifying as secret some public documents previously shared even with the Soviet Union, documents relating to the numbers of strategic weapons in the U.S. nuclear arsenal during the Cold War. The man who claimed to kill JonBenet Ramsey 10 years ago was flown back to the U.S. from Thailand last night and is now jailed in Los Angeles awaiting extradition to Colorado. A woman who's been teaching Sunday school at a Watertown, New York Baptist church for 54 years has been fired because the new minister says the Bible does not permit women to teach men. And news photographer Joe Rosenthal, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his photo of U.S. Marines raising the flag at Iwo Jima in 1945, has died at the age of 94.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of hostility. You married with the best of intentions. Now you need to untie the marital knot with the same mutual respect. Choose collaboration instead of confrontation. Stop wasting money on lawyers. Don't drag this out for 5 years. A collaborative divorce is better for the children, family, and friends. Collaboration costs a fraction of a contended divorce and can be done within weeks rather than the months or years. An award-winning documentary called Divorce Collaborative Style explains how you can end your marriage fairly and efficiently. For less than what a lawyer charges to answer one simple question, you can get all the answers from Divorce Collaborative Style. Go to collaborativedivorce.tv and order your DVD today. If it's over, end it right. collaborativedivorce.tv.
SanDisk Corporation has introduced a new digital music player that stores twice as many songs as the iPod Nano and sells for nearly the same price, just under $250. The company is also cutting the cost of its other models in advance of the holiday season. Munich-based chipmaker Infineon has announced that it has won a contract from the U.S. government to supply chips for a next-generation electronic passport. Home improvement retailer Lowe's is reporting a second-quarter profit of 11%. That's slightly less than analyst estimates, although its sales were modestly better than expected, up 12.2% to $13.4 billion. Freddie Mac has announced a proposed settlement of $4.5 million in resolving a lawsuit filed by the government after the company's restatement of financial results for the year 2000 through 2002. Alaska's Attorney General has subpoenaed BP's documents on corrosion management as the state considers a lawsuit to recover revenues lost when BP shut down its giant Prudhoe Bay oil field because of corrosion in the pipes. Gold is trading this hour at $633 an ounce. Silver's at $12.34 an ounce. And light sweet crude oil is trading up 41 cents at $71.55 a barrel. On Wall Street, all the markets are down this hour. The Dow Jones Industrial is down 35 points. NASDAQ is down 18 points. And the S&P 500 is down 4 to 1,298. More QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Diana Walter.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. The topic today is the future of the labor movement. And to get answers from organized labor and about organized labor, I attended the recent AFL-CIO convention in Northern Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C., and I have got some terrific interviews for you. The first is John Sweeney, the president of the AFL-CIO. He very graciously consented to come on the program. And then I've got Gene Bruskin. He's the director of the Smithfield campaign. You may never have heard of the Smithfield pork processing plant in North Carolina, but you're going to hear about why this is one of the leading targets of abuse and targets of organized labor to stop that abuse. And then finally, the first sitting governor ever to come here on the Inside Scoop, Governor Tim Kaine of Virginia, came on the program. We talked about labor, and I also asked him about Senator George Allen's recent racist comments. You won't want to miss that at the end of the hour. But this is a live show. Feel free to call in, toll free, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. I won't interrupt the interviews, but I'll be happy to take your comments and questions in between them. Let's start right now with John Sweeney, president of the AFL-CIO.
With me now is John Sweeney, the president of the AFL-CIO. Mr. Sweeney, it's truly an honor and a privilege to be able to speak with you. You've probably been in the labor movement longer than I've been alive, so I really respect your dedication. I have to tell you, though, it's not a job I would want, your job, not in a million years. You've got a tough job. It's a tough job for labor these days. You were talking in your speech about wages that have been declining for a very long period of time, and we all know about health care costs, and CEOs are doing very well, and the average working man and woman is not doing so well. What do you attribute this decline to, and what are you doing to change it?
Well, there's several factors that build into the horrible time that it is for workers and for labor unions. And I think shortest answer is to say that the present administration is just so anti-worker and anti-union that it's unbelievable. I mean, we've had Republican administrations in the past that have focused on working family issues and have focused on fairness and justice. What we have right now is an administration that doesn't care. And they're feeding into a very greedy atmosphere amongst corporate America. We have an administration that, whether it's tax policy or it's social programs, the best example is the recent attempt to pass a minimum wage increase for the first time in more than 9 years. But they had to hook it on to a state tax reform for the wealthiest people in our country. It's obscene to treat workers who are at the lowest level of our economic ladder that way. Congress has taken good care of itself over these past 9 years.
Lots of wage increases.
Lots of wage increases, and yet they don't have the will to really increase for those who need it most. This is not just an economic issue. This is a moral issue.
I was just going to say, is this a philosophical question, or is this sort of a corrupt question? Is it because the corporate sponsors are paying, they own these congressmen, they own the president, and that's why they're doing their bidding? Or is there some philosophical reason why they don't like American workers?
I think it's both. I think that there is that strong spirit of not caring for workers or for those who are the neediest. And it's not just minimum wage, it's health care, it's so many, the creation of jobs, as an example. We've lost millions of good paying middle class jobs, mostly in the manufacturing industry, just during the 6 years of this administration. We've had the worst job development record since Herbert Hoover. We organize hundreds of thousands of workers every year. When I say we, the unions of the AFL-CIO. And these good jobs are being replaced by part-time, low-wage jobs, no benefits. I think that there is a moral consideration here that we're seeing with the minimum wage plus all the other things that are going on.
And let me ask you the political question, because there's some that would say, well, that's just sort of the nature of where we are. We're moving from manufacturing to a service economy, so workers get less protection. Is this a natural occurrence that's just with technology, or is this what are the political forces, if you will, that are leading to this?
Well, one has to take into consideration the technological changes that are taking place. One should also be focused on how do we retrain workers for new technology. We can be, and we have been, the most productive nation in the world. We have the most skilled workforce, and we have been able to adjust to technological changes throughout our history. It's a lack of desire to take care of workers with training and education for the new jobs and so on. It's the employers or the entrepreneurs' problem if they can't compete around the world. But you don't have to have a rush to the bottom, searching around for where you can get the cheapest wages, the lowest wages, and exploit people in the developing world.
Let me ask you this, because you talk about around the world, and in your speech, you pointed out that the United States has the greatest gap between rich and poor of any other industrialized nation. So how do other industrialized nations treat their workers? I mean, England, France, Italy, wherever, Japan, Germany, wherever you want to mention, what is it that they're doing that we're not doing that we could be doing to help American workers?
Well, the labor movement in those countries is certainly fighting on behalf of workers in their countries, and they have issues. They're faced with similar interests as we have when it comes to the immigrant workforce, when it comes to outsourcing of jobs, and yet they have been able to handle it in a very positive way. They have national job training programs.
National health care, many of them have it.
They all have, every industrialized country has some form of national health care.
Except us.
Except the United States of America. South Africa was a late starter, but they have national health care now. They have also addressed the retirement security issue a lot better than we are addressing it. And that is a real crisis. That's the newest crisis. We all know about how disastrous it is that 45 million Americans are without health care. But what we haven't seen yet is the full dimensions of what's happening in the pension field. And we see companies taking, employers taking advantage of bankruptcy laws in order to avoid paying, contributing to their pension fund. We see workers' pension funds being wiped out, being reduced. And if you need an indication as to where the administration stands, just look at the attempts to privatize Social Security. They failed at that, and now they're doing everything they can to favor employers who are trying to take advantage of workers' retirement security.
Mr. Sweeney, I'm a lawyer, but I still don't understand how a company can promise a worker for 30, 40 years they're going to get this pension, and it's in their contract, and it's part of the deal. It's what the worker expected. They work there 30, 40 years, they retire. Suddenly, the company is belly up, but the CEO of the company takes home a couple hundred million dollars, and the worker's without any rights. I mean, Enron's the classic example, but there are lots of companies. It's happening right now, isn't it?
There's a lot of Enrons around, and then they're not as highly publicized as Enron, but Enron was a disaster, and it ruined the lives of thousands of workers. It ruined their retirement security. It ruined their ability to send their kids to college, and they were hurt in so many ways. But that's going on in so many different ways by taking the advantages of the loopholes in the bankruptcy laws.
So
as
it's
an
the
example.
Laws that we need to change.
The laws have to be changed, and real pension reform includes the need to reform the bankruptcy laws.
I mean, it would seem to me that if a company is going to promise that they're going to deliver a pension to their workers, they have to put the money aside where no one can touch it, where the CEO can't get his greedy hands in it, or her. Usually it's a him. But it would seem to me that Congress could require a company, if you're going to promise a worker a pension, to put that money aside where you can't touch it. Is that the kind of laws you're seeking?
Sure. I mean, this is the workers' money.
They
agreed to a pension in lieu of wage increases in many cases. As you say, they have earned it. They certainly have. And for them to be at the age of considering retirement and to not know what's going to be there for them and how long it's going to be there is something that is really creating a horror story for many thousands of workers around the country.
So let me ask you a tough question. It's something I've never been able to understand, and I hope you can give me some insight here. I understand why some rich people want to make more money. They don't seem to have enough. They need to have, you know, sculptures that do certain things. Okay, I understand that. And I understand why there's some rich people who are concerned about justice and working people. I get that, too. And I certainly understand the people in the unions who are working to get a better life for them. I get all that. Here's what I don't get. What I don't get is the working people that vote for this administration, that vote for people like Senator George Allen, for people in Congress that consistently harm them. What's going on here I see the polls. There are working people that are increasingly, well, not increasingly, but certainly lately have been deserting the Democratic Party. What's going on, and how do we change that?
Well, I think you're going to see a change in this upcoming election this November. I think that the American people, the average worker, understands better today than ever the attack that's taking place on them. They understand the threat to pension security. They understand the taking away of health benefits in different plans and different scenarios. And they saw the attack on Social Security. They are getting it, I think, I firmly believe. But they also have other issues as well. And we see examples of that in so many different states, and we saw it certainly in the last election. But I think also that we have to, when I say we, those who are supporting change, we have to deliver a good, clear message to workers and their families. We have to make sure that we're building their confidence and trust in those who are delivering the message. And I believe that a lot of that change is taking place.
What are you doing to help rebuild workers' trust in unions, in the Democratic Party, in changing some of these laws?
Well, we have probably over the last two presidential cycles, the exit polls showed the increased number of union members and union household voters who voted in each election, and it went up 3 or 4 points each election cycle. We think it's going to be at its highest, that it will be somewhere close to 30% of the voters will come from union households.
30%?
Yes. we believe that the message that we have been delivering as a union has been well received by Working Americas. This new organization that we created called Working America, which is just 2 years old, is an organization that we send canvassers into communities here in Virginia. There's a very strong movement, and it was very obvious in the last gubernatorial elections. But we now have 1.5 million voters, workers, who are not members of unions, who want to be part of a movement, who identify the same priorities or similar priorities as a worker next door who may be a member of a union. And it's the issues that we're talking about. It's health care, it's retirement security, it's jobs, and it's also education, the environment, and such issues as that. We believe that the more we can educate and motivate these voters, that it will influence them in not just supporting Democrats, but holding all politicians accountable and standing up and expressing themselves. We think over the long term that that's going to be a powerful force. While we see a decline in union membership, it's really not a decline in the numbers. It's more a decline in the percentage of the workforce. And it reflects that our polling shows that more than half unorganized workers would like to join a union today.
More than half.
More than half.
Unorganized workers would like to join a union.
But they have fears. They have fears for their jobs. They see intimidation and coercion among
Walmart,
their employers.
For example.
It's a classic example. One-on-one meetings between the employer's representative and the worker themselves, and the threats that go on.
So let's say we got the government we wanted. Let's say the Democrats take over Congress, November 2006. What can I realize we can't get a new administration for two more years, but what can Congress do? What laws can be changed to help the workers of Walmart? What would you like to see passed?
Well, I would like to see the Employee Free Choice Act passed.
What would that do?
That would provide a more level playing field for workers to express themselves as to whether they want to join a union or not, without intimidation and coercion, without a long, extensive, delayed process such as we see with the National Labor Relations Board today.
You mentioned in your speech that we've got 216 members of the House. You only need 218 for a majority.
Right.
And 43 senators.
Yes.
So presumably in November 2006, that could put the numbers over the top.
We're hopeful that with the changes that we anticipate in the Congress, that we will have a substantial majority in the next session of Congress, and hopeful that we will pass that that bill expeditiously. We have every reason to believe that it probably won't be signed by the President of the United States.
It's kind of, if he vetoes that bill, that'd be only his second veto in his term, and I would think there'd be a lot of complaints around the country.
Yeah, well, as long as he continues to listen to corporate America about what the federal government's worker policy should be, we would look forward to seeing him change, but based on the record of the past 6 years, we fear the worst.
Let me briefly move from federal issues. I know you're the president of the National AFL-CIO, but to right here in Virginia. You did mention you helped get Governor Kaine elected. How's he doing with labor? I know that he appointed someone that that the Republicans in the Virginia legislature, because of his ties to labor, could not be in his cabinet for the first time in so many years. What is Tim Kaine doing for working men and women in Virginia, and what can Virginians do to help him do that job?
Well, I think the governor is really trying to implement a program that he talked a lot about during the campaign, and I think relatively short time that he's been in office, but every indication is that that he is trying to move programs, whether it's education or it's roads and highways and other issues that the people of Virginia really seem to have a strong desire to improve. But I think that Tim Kaine will not change his colors in terms of how strong he has been a supporter of working family issues, but a very fair person and one who realizes that he has to promote the development of business in the state. The economy, he has to focus on the economy and job creation, and I think that he will be working with all of the Virginia in trying to achieve this program. the recommendation or the nomination for Danny LeBlanc to be in the cabinet, I think, was a well-deserved designation.
But it was because of his labor ties, it seems, the Republicans didn't want him there. I mean, why do Republicans hate unions so
well,
much?
Well, there are some folks in the legislature who have a long record of being anti-worker. I guess that Danny LeBlanc, the focus on a person of Danny LeBlanc's experience, and his, he's a very able, intelligent man, but he is, as you would expect, focused very much on workers' issues. But he would be very fair in that position if he had been confirmed, and I'm happy that the governor is still using his talents in his administration.
And we're going to have the governor on just right here on the Inside Scoop. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
For coming on.
Nice to be with you.
Appreciate it.
Keep up the good work.
Thanks.
The United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights meet your most complex needs by providing productivity, competitiveness, reliability, accuracy, safety, leadership, and professionalism. Millwrights from the United Brotherhood of Carpenters are problem solvers. They accept any challenge and approach every project with the highest of competence and training. The UBC has thousands of professionals who can be at your service, giving you the best in business, anytime and every time. The Head On Radio Network is proud to be sponsored by these wonderful men and women who are building the American dream every day. Thank you from the Head On Radio Network.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm here reporting live from the AFL-CIO convention, and I'm talking with Gene Bruskin. He's the director of the Smithfield Campaign for the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. Now, Smithfield Packing Plant is in southeastern North Carolina, and you have a whole campaign devoted to exposing them. Is that right?
Right.
Now, where is it? What does it do?
It's in Tar Heel, North Carolina, which is in a rural area in the southeastern part of the state. They have 5,500 workers in this plant. It's the largest pork processing plant in the world. They kill 32,000 hogs a day. 1,000 an hour come by when you're on the shift. And the work is brutal. The speed line is unforgiving, and the company is in totally denying the respect, dignity, and human rights of its employees, and has been for more than a dozen years.
So workers are working basically on the assembly line, chop off the pig's feet or head and everything.
It's a kill plant.
It's a kill plant. Now, you know, I'm one of those that reads those old books. I remember Upton Sinclair, The Jungle, the meat processing plant. In fact, Upton Sinclair was one of the founders of the labor movement and talked about organizing, and I remember people were worried that their hands were going to get chopped off. Specifically, what is going on that is harmful to workers in this plant?
Okay. Well, ironically, you mentioned Upton Sinclair. It's 100 years of the anniversary of the writing of The Jungle, and I just reread it recently. I must say it was painful because of how familiar it is right now.
Still,
in Tar Heel, North Carolina.
The same abuses. I mean, I remember that the Lithuanian immigrants, I read this book
years ago,
but you know, one of them could get a hand chopped off.
Right.
They would have no vacation time. They had to work 6 days a week.
Right.
Specifically, what's going on in the Smithfield plant?
Well, you have, if you think about it, when you have 1,000 pigs coming by every hour, right? And whatever your role is on the line, let's say it's a cut or a chop or that kind of a maneuver, because you're cutting up the pig as it goes down the assembly line. You're doing that to 1,000 pigs an hour.
Yeah.
Right? So you have frequently rotator cuff injuries, all kinds of, what they call carpal tunnel repetitive stress injuries, where your body just essentially, all the joints just essentially decay. You've got lots and lots of back injuries. A lot of slipping is not unusual. What happens is that when you start cut pieces of meat fall on the floor and you have a wet, cold floor or a wet, hot floor and you step on a piece of meat, it's very dangerous. People pull the meniscus on their knees.
Then you've got cuts.
Yeah. Then you're working with really
sharp knives.
Just to give you a sense of how scary it is to be up there with these really sharp knives, we had one woman that came into our office who told us that she was more than 8 months pregnant. She's still working on the line. And she said that she's afraid because her supervisor has been intimidating her. She's afraid to take off the rest of the time for her pregnancy. And she said the line speed is so fast that the day before she had come into our office, the day before, one of the people wasn't there on the line. And they're working with these knives, and the guy next to her almost hit her in the stomach.
Wow.
So
now,
that's the kind of condition.
One of your complaints, I assume the main complaint about the Smithfield packing plant, is they're not unionized.
Right.
And they don't allow union to organize there?
This company is union in Iowa. It's union in Kansas. It's union in Ohio.
But in North Carolina,
they have fought for a dozen years. They have violated the National Labor Relations Act in innumerable instances by doing things like beating people up, threatening them with deportation, threatening to close the plant, spying on them. There's a list of violations a mile long.
Let me ask you this. They are unionized in other places. There are pork processing plants that are unionized.
Right.
How does a union shop, doing the same stuff, still cutting the pigs, still providing it, how do they treat their workers better? What happens in a union shop to prevent a person from getting those mm-hmm. same repetitive injuries? How could it be improved?
Right.
What would
it's a good
different?
Question. Working in a pork kill proc plant or a hog plant or something, it's hard work.
Sure, right? in any shop,
right.
Union
but,
or non-union.
When you pile on top of that the absolute lack of respect and dignity that you get in a non-union plant becomes unbearable. In a union plant, you have a signed contract. That contract gives you the right, for example, if you are unfairly accused or mistreated in any way, to have your day in court. You can have a meeting with your supervisor and have a shop steward there. Most of unions have health and safety committees and health and safety languages that is legally binding on the company because they've signed the contract that says that you have to conduct the plant in such and such a ways, otherwise we have certain rights.
So does that mean that some guy wouldn't have to do the same repetitive injury for an hour? He might do this for an hour and then do something else for an hour?
Mean that he has language that allows him to rotate to different jobs. Might mean more frequent breaks. It might mean that the line speed could be something that the union could have an impact on in their health and safety meetings and say, no, you're speeding up the line, slow it down, you're making us work too hard. And it might mean, for example, something as basic as the right to go to the bathroom. When you have a pregnant woman standing on the line, not allowed to go to the bathroom without the supervisor's permission, and frequently denied that right, then you really have all kinds of problems and indignities going on.
And she's afraid that she can't quit the job, have her baby, and come back because her job won't be there when she comes back?
Well, they pretty much tell you that in many cases. One of the most outrageous things that goes on in the plant, and we're about to release a documented health and safety report on Labor Day to give evidence to this from government records, that frequently, the injury rate is going up dramatically in the plant. And what we hear repeatedly when we talk to workers is they're afraid to report the injury. Because if they report the injury, they potentially will get an argument from the boss who will regularly say, how do we know that this problem you're having now with your wrist was caused at work? Maybe it happened last night by something you did at home. And then if a worker persists...
But there's worker compensation laws or the Family Medical Leave Act. There are laws on the book that are supposed to protect workers.
Absolutely.
Do you think this company is in violation of the law?
I believe that to be the case.
So is it going to be a lawsuit?
Well, we are...
call the ACLU, right?
Call the ACLU. We believe that this is a regular occurrence because workers, unrelated to each other, tell us this on a regular basis. What happens in the plan a lot is that you come to the company with an injury that they send you to their clinic. The clinic may or may not treat it adequately, but then the company doesn't sign you up as a work-related injury. Therefore, you are expected to come back to work. If you take time off, you're not covered under the workers' compensation law except for a very short period of time. So they will try to skirt the law or deny it, and in some cases people actually get fired for insisting on it.
Do you know, will there be a lawsuit, a class action, anything coming out of this?
Well, we
I'm a lawyer,
this,
so yeah, I can think in legal terms.
Well, we believe that coming out of this health and safety report and the documentation we have, that there should definitely be legal action taken.
Now, you told us that the Smithfield plant in Iowa and Kansas, some other places, was unionized. Presumably these abuses don't happen in those plants.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So and why is North Carolina? Is it the state? Is it why is this particular plant being so difficult when the rest of the company's plants are apparently decent operations?
Right. Well, it has to do with the sort of the way the company developed as a corporation. They developed by acquiring plants primarily. So many of their plants around the country, for the most part, were other companies like John Morrell, Gwaltney. They had other names. They've been union for decades. They bought them. They kept the union. In 1992, they opened the mother of all plants on their own in North Carolina, and that's this one.
Now, have the workers had an opportunity to even vote on whether to have a union there?
Well, it depends on what you consider an opportunity. There was an election in 1994, shortly after the...
12 years ago.
Yeah. And it was a very close election, and the board, the National Labor Relations Board, found... some charges against the company, and the company
charges like manipulating the voting, that
Or violations of the Labor Act, which are like various kinds of intimidation and so on. And the company then met with the union and basically signed a letter of agreement to conduct this next election fairly. In 1997, an election was conducted, and during that election, the labor violations went through the roof. They surrounded the vote with deputy sheriffs with rifles. They beat people up right at the board at the conclusion of the vote in front of the National Labor Relations Board.
They beat people up in front of the board?
Yeah, they arrested some people. They fired people.
And members of the board were there and saw this?
Well, some of that, the beating up, they were right there. It was right there as the vote was concluded. So we then filed charges, and repeatedly, both under the Clinton and then under the Bush Labor Board, found every single charge that we held, and there were dozens and dozens of them, to be true, using racial slurs, all that kind of stuff. And then the company appealed it to the U.S. Court of Appeals, and in 2006 of April, after 9 years of appeals, after having promised from the previous election to do the right thing, the Labor Board said, the company said, okay, we won't appeal it anymore. Let's vote tomorrow. But what we're ready to vote, yeah.
So are you going to hold an election?
Well, it's sort of like if you've polluted the waters so seriously and drastically for more than a decade.
People are scared now.
It's laughable for the company to say that they're going to respect the rights of workers, because since the 97 election, they have repeatedly violated the National Labor Relations Act in other instances. So they have no credibility. What happened is that starting after the union went through all these years of appeals, starting in June of 2006, the union began a national campaign, and that's where you referred to in the beginning, where we are going across the country and telling consumers that Smithfield products are packaged with abuse. We've had our stories in the Wall Street Journal, in the New York Times, in the Chicago Tribune, in Latino and
Now, what are Smithfield products? I mean, our listeners should know what they shouldn't buy.
Okay. Well, the products that come out of this plant like the Lean Generation products.
So Lean Generation
lean,
is a company.
Smithfield Lean Generation.
All right.
Came
packaged
out of here.
Packaged with abuse.
Packaged with abuse.
What else?
Anything that says Smithfield Bacon on it, which is a huge product.
Smithfield Bacon.
Was the pig was killed in that plant. Then, for the most part, any of the products that actually say Smithfield on it, as opposed to one of their other companies, were produced in this plant.
You know, how do you know? I mean, you don't want to hurt the
we don't want to hurt the
Iowa
plants,
and
yeah.
Kansas.
Good
couldn't
question.
Maybe Smithfield products? I mean,
well, here's the way we know. We know the names of the products, right? And if you go to our website, www.smithfieldjustice.com, you can see the names. But the way we know for sure is that under the USDA, Department of Agriculture rules, everything that comes out of the plant has to be stamped with a number. And if it says 18079 on that pork, then it came out of that plant.
18079.
And if it says 79C on the bacon, that pig was killed in that plant.
People aren't going to remember that. 18079.
Yeah.
79C.
But mostly what you have to do is look on the... if you look at the name of it, it says Smithfield on it, it's probably out of that plant.
The
products coming out of
the
other plants frequently say... Gwaltney or John Morrell or the other names of the products.
I will post that on my website so people can find out. So tell me this. When does the campaign end? I assume you're doing this campaign because it's one of the worst companies in the nation. Is that
That's
fair
right.
to say? When
we
does it
that.
End? They say they're going to have an election. What do they have to do to satisfy you that they're coming around treating the workers well?
Well, it's a good question. First of all, they have to stop the daily abuse. You know, we have to see some real signs in just in right in front of the workers' faces. You know, the injury denials, the disrespect and the insult, the sexual harassment on the job and so on. Most importantly, though, they have a relationship with this union. We represent 13,000 or more of their workers around the country. They deal with us every day. They could sit down with this union anytime, work out a fair process for the workers to choose to have a union, to have a union contract without any intimidation or interference on the company's part.
So are y'all picketing the place now? Or?
Well, it's not really a picket, you know, because workers...
Don't stand out there with signs.
No, workers are working. They got to work, right?
Right.
For example, 2 weeks ago, 1,000 workers inside the plant wore this T-shirt to work to announce to the company on a single day.
That's a scary thing for those workers.
It is
be
a scary
afraid
thing.
Of, I wouldn't know if I'd want to wear one of those.
It took a lot of courage, total defiance. We're talking also a plant that's probably about 45% or so Latino, about 40% or more African American. These are groups that frequently don't work together. They're all wearing their T-shirts because they're all suffering this abuse.
Gene Breskin, thank you for coming on.
All right, thank you very much for
Appreciate
having me.
Appreciate it. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this. But take a look, if you can, at Gene Breskin's T-shirt, Justice at Smithfield at www.smithfieldjustice.com. You can find more information on it and know what pork products you shouldn't be buying because they're packaged with abuse.
It's really an extraordinary situation. I hope everyone will take a look into it. This is Mark Levine Live, and we've got a first-time caller, Sarge from Mississippi, on the line. Sarge, welcome to the Inside Scoop. Do we have Sarge from Mississippi?
I appreciate it.
There you are. Sarge, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
It's nice to talk with you, Mark. I've heard of you quite often, and you are certainly living up to the bill.
Well, thank you so much. Tell me, what do you think about either the Smithfield plant or John Sweeney's interview?
Well, you know, I heard them talking on KLSD about them yesterday, and I plan to call them and do an interview and write it up in my column at Powers and Morrison. But, you know, Mississippi is a red state, and we have plenty of companies that follow that same pattern right here in this state. In fact, the town that I live in, there's a furniture factory that has toxic chemicals that they use, and they deny it, and yet workers get sick and develop diseases because of toxic chemicals. And that's what you get.
Help me understand something. I've never understood this, and maybe you can help. Why is it that Mississippi, one of the poorest states in the United States, is one of the reddest states in the United States? Can you explain
that?
Well,
it is a poor state. It is a poor state, and... The big,
why are they voting for Republicans that persecute the poor?
Yeah, Yeah, you know, that's that, they've got this thing that they spread through the state that says unions are bad, that if you're in a union, that the union's going to take your money and they're going to abandon you, which is, you know, right-wing trash, because the fact is, if unions are where we got most of our good stuff that we have today.
Sure. So why do people believe it? Is it their churches telling them that? Is it something else? What's going on here?
Yeah, a lot of it's the church, and then the media, ever since I was a little boy, and I'm over 50 years old, has been slanted. It never has been open and honest. And now with all these deregulations and the changes in the laws, they've gotten even worse. So the people here don't really hear the story. And the Democrats are really kind of missing the boat some, because there's so much that they could do here and speak out on that they're not doing. And this only empowers people like Lott and Barber. It's just a political travesty.
Sarge, I want to talk with you further, but I got to put one more interview today. I've got Governor Tim Kaine of Virginia, who is a Southern Democrat. I tell you, though, I hope you'll call back another time and we can talk about these issues further. Will you do that?
Sure will. Sure will. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Coming up after the break, I've got the first sitting governor ever on the Inside Scoop, a Democrat Governor Tim Kaine. He's going to talk about labor. And he's also going to talk about Governor Allen's racist comment. Coming up right after the break.
Guy James Means, straight talk, and great guests like author and reporter Greg Palast.
Do we have Greg on the phone?
Yes, we do.
All right, very good, Greg.
Greg talked about his new book, Armed Madhouse.
You'll see in the second chapter of the book about big oil that I was able to get the inside documents from the inside the State Department for the plans for the oil fields of Iraq, which is, you know, what it, you know, it's about the oil. And you actually, you know, if you thought they had a secret plan, I go and get it.
Greg Palast, thank you so much.
Don't miss Guy James weekday afternoons, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Sitting next to me, it is my honor and privilege to have His Excellency, the Governor of Virginia, Tim Kaine. Tim Kaine, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Mark, great to be with you today.
You spoke, of course, before a labor convention, and there are some that say that organized labor is really losing its power in America, but you attributed your election in part or largely to organized labor. How is organized labor doing in Virginia and in the United States?
You know, there's in Virginia, organized labor, you know, they have been losing members, but I see, you know, some new signs of strength. And in particular in my campaign, what organized labor did in a very effective way was reach out to working people generally, may not be labor members, but just people who are sympathetic to issues like, you know, minimum wage, better working conditions, health care security. Organized labor reached out and they found about 50,000 people in addition to their roles who care deeply about issues affecting workers, and they got them mobilized for the campaign, and I think that was a very good strategy.
Now, of course, you are trying to give back to the people that brought you to the table.
Absolutely.
And you tried to put in your cabinet and eventually succeeded, we'll talk about, but the first time, I think, in Virginia's history, correct me if I'm wrong, a member of organized labor in the cabinet.
Right. There had never been a member of organized labor in the cabinet. I wanted to rectify that, and so I proposed Danny LeBlanc, who was a longtime leader of the AFL-CIO here, to be my Secretary of the Commonwealth. He would have done a fantastic job. The legislature rejected him, but then I put him in another cabinet position, which is basically the Secretary for Workforce Development. Danny has done workforce development issues, you know, his whole career. And so he's now leading a really important effort to take all the different workforce development pieces we have in state government and kind of streamline, pull them together, make sure we're getting the biggest bang for the buck. But, yeah, I was very surprised that the legislature you know, I have folks from business in my cabinet, and that's the way it ought to be. I have folks from the education, higher education in my cabinet. That's the way it should be. From agriculture in my cabinet. What's wrong with having somebody from a working background or who's part of labor in the cabinet?
Let me ask you this, because I believe, as you said, this was the first time in the entire history of the Commonwealth?
Yes.
350 years?
I don't. Well, there's only been a cabinet since 1972.
Okay,
so
fine.
I mean, I can.
But, okay, so
yeah.
Fine. But in the history of the Commonwealth, they rejected someone in the cabinet because they're from labor.
Right.
Can you explain to me the antipathy for, you know, why the Republicans in the legislature dislike working people? I don't get it.
Well, I don't either. I mean, they represent a lot of working people, and so, you know, I feel like, you know, to some degree it was, well, Danny has often been with labor and hadn't supported us in past campaigns. That's true enough, but every governor brings in their own team.
Sure.
And I have three Republicans in my cabinet. I mean, I built a team that really was the best person for every job to serve the entire Commonwealth. And I believe that Danny was one of those best people. I mean, having worked with him for a long time, I knew he would be one of the best. As it turns out, he and I kind of laughed about it after the fact. The position that he's in now in this workforce development area, he may even be able to make more of a mark in that position than when I originally proposed for him. And I ended up getting a great Secretary of the Commonwealth, too, to your watchers. Kate Hamley from Fairfax, who's a longtime friend, is my new Secretary of the Commonwealth, and she's doing a great job. So I kind of got a twofer out of it, and Danny's doing a great job in the workforce development area.
Let me ask you this. In terms of overall levels, both the United States and Virginia,
mm-hmm.
certainly in the United States, workers are having some hard times. Mm-hmm. In the 90s, wages were going up.
Right.
The rich were getting richer, but the poor were getting richer, too. The middle
mm-hmm.
class, everyone was better off. Since about 2001, nationally, working wages have gone down. Real
mm-hmm.
wages after inflation are not doing so well. Now, Mark Warner, to some extent, was against that. To some extent, workers did better,
I think,
in Virginia
mm-hmm.
than nationally.
Right.
What did he do? What are you doing to make Virginia the exception? And what can you continue to do to make Virginia the exception?
Well, you know, what we try to do is just be as diligent as we can about economic development and bring economic development opportunities here, and with a particular focus on the parts of the state that have the most need. You know, Virginia, thank goodness, we have one of the lowest unemployment rates in the nation for a large state. There are some very small states that have lower rates, but you don't see big states like Virginia with rates that we have. That's takes a lot of work to get there.
How do you get there? Why do we have a large unemployment?
Couple of things. We have a very, you know, we do have a very business-friendly tax, regulatory, and legal environment that enables us to bring businesses in. Second, we got a really strong education system. I mean, we can always improve, and we need to. But compared to other states, both K-12 and higher ed is strong. And now in the 21st century world, when businesses look around the world, where do we want to locate? They want to go where the education is strong. So if we keep pushing that, that'll help us. And then the third thing I think we have is we're in a global world now. You know, some of our job losses, we just had an announcement of a job loss in Southside yesterday, are businesses moving overseas. And that causes a lot of anxiety among working people, and it should. But the good news is Virginia is more positioned to capture the value of global economy than most states. Dulles Airport, you know, 3 miles from where we're sitting here today, you can get on a plane and fly to most continents nonstop. Well, most states don't have that kind of a travel connection with the rest of the world. Port of Virginia, one of the busiest ports in North America, connected to the entire rest of the world in terms of freight. Most states don't have that. So I think one of the reasons why we're successful and why we do attract jobs is, again, you know, we start off with a good base of people, hardworking people, strong education system, favorable business climate, and we're connected to this global economy that we're in now.
Let me ask you this. You got 3.5 more years as governor.
Mm-hmm.
What
yep.
can you do, what are you doing to help the average working person in Virginia? And let's be frank here,
mm-hmm.
who's stymieing you? To the extent that you're not able to
sure.
succeed, what are the problems?
Well, I mean, the main thing, you know, you start off with, you got to put together an administration that includes a lot of, you know, people who are just, you know, not just the campaign donors, but people from all kinds of backgrounds. And working people have they got a voice at my cabinet table and in many of the positions in my administration. Second, we got to keep pushing on, you know, some of the basics. I mean, transportation solutions, better education system, health care, both so that we live healthier, but also that more people have access to care. If you do those things, you will help working people with the challenges they face
specific.
Every day.
You mm-hmm. mentioned teacher salaries.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You're helping those go up.
Yep. There was a budget that I inherited when I came in office, and I worked hard to adjust and amend it so that we increased teacher salaries. So we got to be near the average in teacher pay. We're short on nurses, critical health care professionals, and so we're doing things like scholarship programs and incentives to get more people into the nursing field.
Now, how about the minimum wage? It hasn't been increased the federal level in 10 years, what can you do in Virginia?
My traditional position on the minimum wage is it's really important for the federal government to do it because, you know, if you get out of whack with other states, then they can use that against you. But if we, you know, at some point, you wait around for the federal government and they won't do it, and then states start to take up that initiative themselves. And I'm now open to that issue because I'm so, frankly, pessimistic that the federal government will do anything about it.
A couple other worker issues, health care, mm-hmm. pensions. What can you do as governor to help?
On the pension side, you know, not that much. I mean,
because the federal government controls all
the
industry.
The ERISA federal law is kind of, you know, the be all and end all of pensions. But on the healthcare side, you know, we've got a million plus Virginians who are not insured. I think there are a number of things that we can do. We passed a bill this year, for example, that let small businesses come together to buy health insurance products together. A lot of small businesses can't afford health insurance. So this insurance pooling bill that we passed will help a lot of small businesses be able to buy insurance for their employees. And we're looking at other strategies to get that million-plus number down. And I think there are things we can do at the state level there.
Now, we're here in Northern Virginia. Mm-hmm. I understand you had trouble getting to here because there was a traffic problem.
Yeah.
Those of us here in Northern Virginia understand
right,
getting caught in
you
traffic.
You feel my pain. Is
we do.
Talking.
We do. We want you to feel our pain perhaps a little bit. Mm-hmm. I know you've been working very hard to get transportation, not just for Northern Virginia, but the Hampton Roads throughout the state. What's the problem here?
Well,
who's in your way? I mean, let's be honest.
Yeah, well, I'll be blunt. The Senate and I want to do something about it. And the House, especially the House Republican leadership, said, we're not going to talk about transportation until we get a budget and the session is over. And I said, well, look, we haven't dealt with it for 20 years. We've done a million studies. We can do it now. Let's do it now. Nope, we're not going to talk about it until the session is over. So I wish they hadn't done it, but they did. The session's now over. We have a budget. They've promised as soon as the session's over, then we'll have a plan to come back in and deal with transportation. They have bills from the Senate sitting on their desk for when they come back, and I've got to take them at their word. You know, we could have done it during the regular session, but we didn't. That's water under the bridge. Let's be serious about it now.
Is it going to happen this year?
I'm more optimistic today than I was a month ago. The question is, will something happen that is that's meaningful and positive? The Northern Virginia problem is the most acute. We've got to come up with a solution here. It's very significant in Hampton Roads as well. Hampton Roads has the additional dynamic of hurricane evacuation routes, which are really important. But then you go to the other parts of the state, even if they're not congested, many of them need roads for economic development. And so it's an important issue everywhere. I'm very focused on it. This is the issue that's, you know, occupied most of my time in the first year, and appropriately so. It's urgent. I think we can do something about it, and we need to.
And if not, we have to elect new people in 2007.
If we don't deal with transportation, then I fully expect people to go to the ballot box and express their displeasure with people who are standing in the way.
One last issue, mm-hmm. the Virginia Senate race.
Yep.
One of the things that you mentioned in your speech mm-hmm. is talking about people moving into Virginia, making this a welcoming
right.
environment for everyone.
Right.
Here we have an American, a Virginian, born
right.
here, of Indian descent. We have a racial slur directed at him mm-hmm. by a sitting United States Virginia senator. And let's face it, Virginia has got this tension between
right.
past and present. I mean, you know, you study the history
right.
books, you look at cases like Loving View, Virginia, when mm-hmm. Virginia's got a really bad name for, you know, mm-hmm. at that time. You've got Confederacy, where George Allen
right.
seems to be still waving the flag. What do you think needs to be done to make Virginia more
yeah.
tolerant for the future and
well,
to
those,
get rid of
you know,
some of these?
Those of us, you know, those of us in leadership positions, we just got to make clear that Virginia is open to everybody. I mean, singling out, you know, a native-born Fairfax County person saying welcome to America, it's an insult. I mean, this is a, you know, Fairfax, native-born, TJ High School, University of Virginia, acting like he, you know, is some stranger. It's ridiculous, especially from a guy who was born in California. We've got to be open. You know,
I don't know how it's you explain
we're a commonwealth, you know. Commonwealth means we're all in this together. Virginia